The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Frank Wilson, and once upon a time, I was the book editor of The Enquirer. Tonight, I have the privilege of introducing William Kennedy and Paul Hendrickson. Although best known as a novelist, William Kennedy is also a playwright and a screenwriter. Like James Joyce, Kennedy has fictionally turned his hometown into a microcosm. In Kennedy's case, the town is Albany, New York. In his award-winning novel, Ironweed, for instance, Albany serves as the centerpiece around which the plot unfolds. So it is hardly surprising that in his latest novel, Chango's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, the first six pages take place in Albany. The year is 1936, and 8-year-old Daniel Quinn wakes up in the middle of the night to find Bing Crosby jamming downstairs for his father and some of his father's many acquaintances. But in the next section, which begins on page 7, we are nowhere near upstate New York. We're in Havana. It's 1957, and 29-year-old Daniel Quinn is a larval journalist hoping to follow in the footsteps of his grandfather, who had tracked down the big-name Cuban revolutionary of his day. Daniel does better than that. On his first night in Havana, he meets not only Ernest Hemingway, but also the love of his life, a beauty, a dark beauty, named Renata. Eventually, he'll get to interview the current big-name revolutionary, a fellow named Fidel Castro. Quinn thinks that what he's doing is, and I quote, a continuation of an earlier life choice, to be a witness, a writer. He has a strong impulse to salvage history, which is so fragile, so prismatic, so easily twisted, so often lost and forgotten. But we know that Quinn is too imaginative to settle just on transcribing events. He wants to get to the bottom of them. This becomes clear in the next section, which takes place in Albany. In 1968, Bobby Kennedy has been killed. Racial tensions are high. And in the middle of it all is a now seasoned Daniel Quinn, who is starting to think that fiction may be truer to life than plain fact. And that's all I'm going to tell you. Joining Kennedy on stage tonight is Paul Hendrickson, a University of Pennsylvania professor and the author of multiple award-winning books. His 2003 book, Sons of Mississippi, which studied the legacy of racism in the families of seven sheriffs during the 1960s, won him the National Book Critics Circle Award for General Nonfiction. Of his latest book, Hemingway's Boat, Hendrickson says at the start that it isn't meant to be a Hemingway biography, not in any conventional sense. And it's not. It's a lot better than that, in large measure because of what Hendrickson calls, quote, the zigzags and looparounds and time bends and flashbacks and flash forwards and other sorts of departures from the main frame. So the focus is on what might be called Hemingway's most lasting love affair with his fishing boat, named Pilar, after a shrine in Spain dedicated to Our Lady of the Pillar. The religious connotation is strangely pertinent since it is Hendrickson's contention that Hemingway was on a lifelong quest for sainthood, and not just literary sainthood. And at every turn, he defeated himself. This could have been a very sad book about a man who, in Andrew Turnbull's words, ate his publicity and became a travesty of his former self. As it happens, the book is simply immensely moving. It rescues a great writer from both his legend and the scholarship industry, and also demonstrates that Hemingway was not without greatness as a man. And that, you will be pleased to learn, is all that you are going to hear from me. It's a pleasure to have both these authors here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming William Kennedy and Paul Hendrickson. Paul will come out first.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks very much.
Good evening, and thank you very much for coming. It's always a great pleasure for me to come to this library. I just think it's one of the great library buildings in America. I've participated in several programs here, just architecturally, let alone the volumes and volumes that it houses. I want to thank Andy Cahan, who puts on these programs so beautifully, week after week and month after month. And it was my pleasure to meet for the first time Mr. Wilson, who just eloquently introduced us both. I was a longtime reader of Mr. Wilson and knew of his esteem as the book editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, but we had never met until this evening. I'm very thrilled that a couple of my students from the University of Pennsylvania made it here tonight. Welcome to them. But most of all, I am very honored to be on the same stage, sharing the same stage with William Kennedy, and he insists that I call him Bill. I'm going to call him for the moment Mr. Kennedy, but he kept saying, you must call me Bill. I even brought to show him my beat-up copy, paperback of Ironweed, which was the first novel that I caught up to in the famous Albany cycle of novels, and who can forget that great, great saga. And I remember vividly in 1983 reading my copy of Ironwood because my wife Cecilia and I were expecting our first child, and I was reading a lot of things and doing my job at the Washington Post, but I can squint and see myself reading that novel, and so it's thrilling to be here with someone of your stature tonight, Bill, Mr. Kennedy. And I'd like, as a last thing, just to give a quick shout-out to my wife, Cecilia, who accompanied me here tonight and who is the ballast and anchor of this all. I feel that my job really is to say my little piece and get off and cede the microphone and the time largely to Mr. Kennedy. So I promise, I just took off my watch, I'm going to be done inside of 20 minutes. It'll probably be closer to 15. And I will try to say something about this book I've written. And I'm going to adapt to some of my own words and indeed pick up some of the echoes that Frank Wilson just was alluding to. The watery book that I have been working on for roughly the last 7 years, and that has taken me from Havana to Key West to Oak Park, Illinois, to Idaho, to northern Michigan, and to a lot of other watery and non-watery points in between, isn't meant to be Hemingway biography, not in any conventional sense. We've had far too many biographies in the past 50 years, not to say Daffy critical studies and even Daffier psychological explanations of the man. The work instead has been trying to come to a modest understanding of the almost insanely complicated life of Ernest Hemingway through the narrative lens of something in the material world he loved very much, a possession intimately his and he hers for 27 years, which were his final 27 years. Her name was Pilar, and she was his 38-foot seagoing, motorized fishing vessel, and she lasted him through three wives, the Nobel Prize, and all his ruin. He owned her, fished her, worked her, rowed her from the waters of Key West to the Bahamas, to the Dry Tortugas, to the North Coast and archipelagos of Cuba. She wasn't a figment or a dream or a literary theory or somebody's psychosexual interpretation. No. She was actual. Onto her varnished decks, hauled in over her low-cut stern on a large wooden roller, had come uncounted marlin, and broadbill swordfish, tuna, sailfish, kingfish, snook, wahoo, tarpon, horse-eyed jacks, pompano, dolphin, barracuda, bonito, and mako shark, which, as Hemingway once said, are the ones that smell oddly sweet and have those curved-in teeth that give them their Spanish name, dentuso. This factory-made craft, sturdy, faithful, humble by 30s yachting standards, became the structural prism and the storytelling device and the organizing principle through which I searched for the man himself. If I've spent seven some years writing Pilar in my head as a metaphor and narrative vehicle, would that I could have had one real ride on her and felt her under me in a wholly different way. I say 7 years, but in truth, I think the origins go back at least through three decades and four intervening books, to say just a little bit of it. In early 1980, on the island of Bimini, when my wife and I were in weekend escape from the snows of Washington, D.C., I encountered Ernest Hemingway's little brother, Les Hemingway, 16 years his junior, whom he used to call the Baron when he was being kindly to him. The Baron, in his mid-60s, was sort of a failed man. Who could ever live under the shadow of the Hemingway volcano? And yet a very nice guy. He told me some incredibly sad family stories that weekend. Maybe this is where the idea first seeded itself. I don't really know. Maybe I don't want to know. You see, I've long believed that our writing projects find us, not we them, and sometimes the finding can be a half-alert thing winding on for years. What we need to do is be grateful. Hemingway's Boat is largely the story of the span of years between the first week of April 1934 and the first week of July 1961. But as Frank Wilson indicated, the narrative doesn't always stay there. No human history ever proceeds in a straight line, perhaps least of all Ernest Hemingway's. His prose was wonderfully rooted in geography and linear movement, but his life, like his boat, beat against so many cross currents. It's about the strange, sad distance from a Brooklyn boatyard named Wheeler Shipyard, Inc., to a tight, oak-paneled entryway in a bunker-like house in Ketchum, Idaho, when the world went away from a suffering man in fractions of a second. My aim has been to try to lock together the words Hemingway and boat in the way that the locked together and equally American words DiMaggio and bat, or say Satchmo and horn, will quickly mean something in the minds of most people, at least of a certain age. It's about such ideas as fishing, friendship, fatherhood, love of water, and what it means to be masculine in our culture, as that culture is now rapidly changing, and the notion of being boat-struck, and how the good deep in us is often matched only by the perverse bad in us, and not least about the damnable way our demons seem to end up always following us, even when we think we've escaped them and are out cruising on the stream. The Gulf Stream, that belt of deep blue water, which Hemingway thought of almost mystically as the Great Blue River. In late May of 2005, I went to Cuba to see the stream for myself, but more importantly, to behold in the flesh, so to speak, Ernest Hemingway's boat. She was sitting up on concrete blocks like some old and gasping, browned-out whale, maybe 100 yards from his house, under a kind of gigantic carport with a corrugated plastic roof on what was once his tennis court, just down from the now-drained pool where Ava Gardner had reputedly swum nude. Even in her diminished, dry-docked, parts-plundered state, I knew Pilar would be beautiful, and she was. I walked round and round her. I took rolls and rolls and pictures of her long, low hull, of her slightly raked mahogany stern, of her nearly vertical bow. When the guards weren't looking, I reached over and touched her surface. The wood, marbled with hairline fissures, was dusty, porous, dry. It seemed almost scaly. It felt febrile. It was as if Pilar were dying from thirst. It was as if all Pilar wanted was to get into water. But even if it were possible to hoist her with a crane off of those blocks and to ease her onto a flatbed truck and to take her away from that steaming hillside and set her gently into Havana Harbor, would Hemingway's boat go down like a stone, boiling and bubbling to the bottom, her insides having long ago been eaten out by termites and other barely visible critters? A man who let his own insides get eaten out by the diseases of fame had dreamed new books on this boat. He had taught his sons to reel in something that feels like Moby Dick on this boat. He had accidentally shot himself in both legs on this boat. He had fallen drunk from the flying bridge on this boat. He'd written achy, generous, uplifting, poetic letters on this boat. He had propositioned women on this boat. He had hunted German subs on this boat. He had saved family members from shark attack on this boat. He had acted like a boor and a bully and an overly competitive jerk on this boat. And now Hemingway's boat sat beached and grime-coated and time-stunned in the Cuban sun. When he got this boat, or more precisely, when he placed the order for her and put down $3,000 toward a full purchase price, courtesy of a hastily arranged loan advance from the editor of Esquire magazine against future articles, it was April 5th, 1934, and he was just back from safari in East Africa, having come triumphantly into New York Harbor the day before on the SS Paris. Ernest Miller Hemingway, right then, was not quite 35 years old. He was still living and writing in Key West, a sand-bitten and depression-sagging outpost at the bottom of America. He was rugged, handsome, youthful, trim-waisted, owner of a killer grin and an even more killer ego, the reigning monarch of American literature, a sportsman and a sensualist, glorying in his life in the external physical world. And when he lost Pilar, in that moment when he lost everything, on a summer Sunday in 1961, in a place where the mountains outside his three picture windows in the living room were as jagged as the teeth of a shredding saw. He was 19 days shy of his 62nd birthday, prematurely old, multi-diseased, mentally bewildered, delusional, slurred of speech, in exile from Cuba, from the stream, from Pilar, dislocated by Fidel's revolution, unable to compose so much as one true sentence a day, or so he had wept on a sofa in his Ketchum living room. Is it any wonder that the most imitated writer of the 20th century rose sometime after 7 o'clock that morning, slipped a red silk dressing robe over blue pajamas, put on slippers, moved past the master bedroom where his fourth wife was sleeping, went down the red carpeted stairs, crossed the length of the living room to the kitchen, retrieved the key to the locked storeroom where the weapons were, went down to the basement, took shells from an ammo box, closed and relocked the door, came back upstairs, walked 10 steps to the front entry foyer, opened the entryway door, stepped inside, placed the butt of the gun on the linoleum tile, tore open the breech, slammed in the cartridges, snapped it shut, bent over, as you might bend over a water fountain, rested his forehead against the blue steel, and blew away his entire cranial vault with the double-barreled 12-gauge shotgun with which he had once shot pigeons. Ernest Hemingway has been examined by so many scholars and memoirists and respected biographers and hangers-on and pretenders and doctoral students desperate for a dissertation topic. I feel sometimes we have lost all sense of who the man really was. It's as if each new Hemingway book by each new Hemingway, quote, expert wishes to contradict the last, which is one reason why I was determined to try to anchor a Hemingway narrative, to ground it journalistically, you might say, in something that had existed in the material world. I felt if I could somehow learn what was possible to learn about an object that had meant so much to him, if I could actually lean over and surreptitiously touch it, I might be able to understand things about Hemingway, and not only Hemingway, in ways I had not previously been able to understand. Indeed, I hope to find people who were once on that boat, who had their own deep relationship with her, and tell their stories too. And I did find them, both the living and the dead. In the summer of 1987, as a Washington Post reporter, I searched out and interviewed Hemingway's three sons. Perhaps by then a book or an idea of a book was struggling to get up above ground. Their father had been dead for 26 years, and the sons themselves were late middle-aged men. What I recall so vividly about Jack and Patrick and Gregory Hemingway in their deep psychic sibling pain was their attempt to say how fine it had been to spend time with their father, because when it was good with Papa, nothing better in the world could be. Gregory Hemingway, the youngest son, the most deeply scarred of these three, the most gifted athlete in the family, the one with the truest writing gift, the son who had been given the nickname Gigi by his father, had grown up to be a medical doctor like his paternal grandfather. Gigi had also spent most of his adult life struggling, and heroically seems not too strong a word to me, against the compulsion to dress up his squat, bulky body in hosiery, brassieres, wigs, girdles, makeup, spiked heels, fingernail polish, and then go out into public places talking to people in his deep-chested voice. He was 55 and in the Miami area when he and I met. Coarse gray hair fell in clumps over his face. His teeth were wrecked. He was spending his days in public parks and libraries. He had no fixed address. He had been married and divorced several times. He was estranged from most of his children. The medical career had drained away. Sometimes, he said, he would go out onto Biscayne Bay in a small rowboat to hand fish over the side with a night crawler, to fall asleep in the sun until something below jerked him awake. Gigi said, and it was easy to believe, that he had undergone 98 electroshock treatments. "I've taken every fucking pill there is," he said softly. "These horrible, mixed-up feelings you have, the love and the hate," he said. If Gigi was the son who disappointed Hemingway the most, he was also the son whom Hemingway forsook the least. And I believe that both of them, the one who exploded himself into infinity and the one too long regarded as the genetic blunder of the Hemingway family, were far braver human beings than we ever knew, and that they were locked together more intimately than any of us ever knew. And that's part of what I'm trying to say in this story. Thank you very much.
Good evening. That was wonderful. It's wonderful writing. It's wonderful writing in a different way about all the Hemingway things that you read most of the time in biographies. But there's a great passion in what Paul is writing. I notice I call him Paul, even though he doesn't call me Bill. But the language and his passion bring such vitality to the material that it's no wonder that it's number 14 on the bestseller list this Sunday coming with the New York Times. Hey, nice. I have a Hemingway of a different order. He's a character in this novel that I've written. This novel is called Shango's Beads and Two-Tone Shoes, and about 50% of it is about Cuba, most of it taking place between March the 12th and and maybe a couple of weeks later. I've never really figured that out, when it ends in Cuba. And of course, it really doesn't. But anyway, I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm just going to read it. And then we'll go from there later on, if anybody needs to know anything. Havana, March the 12th, 1957. Quinn met Renata the same night he summoned the courage to talk to Hemingway. She, too, had come to El Floridita to see the great writer, in part because Alejo Carpentier, who was beginning to fall in love with her, spoke well of the man from their days in Paris and thought The Sun Also Rises was masterful. Renata had read much literature and believed she might one day write a novel and would feel stupid if she could have talked to a major living novelist, but had not. She had seen Hemingway looking at paintings in the Palacio de Bellas Artes, where she worked with artists, studied art, and served as a tour guide, a volunteer. She had no need for salaried work. Her family owned two sugar mills on her father's side and tobacco on her mother's. Renata was 23 and for more than a year had been living a dual life as an haute bourgeoise in the heady Cuban social swirl and clandestinely as an associate of revolutionaries who were working to overthrow the government of Fulgencio Batista. One of her revolutionary friends had fought with the Republicans in Spain and later with the American Army in World War II, and he admired Hemingway for being unafraid to dodge bombs in the streets of Madrid. Her brother-in-law, Max, knew Hemingway, and Max told her, "Yes, if you approach him at the Floridita in the right way, he may talk seriously to you. But it'd be better if he was a few daiquiris in before you approached. For the rum brings out his friendly side. He has other sides, and it's better to wait for the rum to do its work so you can avoid those." Quinn had been in the Floridita almost 2 hours. He'd been in Havana a week and had come to the Floridita three nights in a row to wait for Hemingway, who'd never turned up. Then tonight here came the man, alone. He sat on a bar stool in his corner, a bronze bust of himself on a high shelf over the end of the bar, and he chatted with the bartender. But he also turned his back on two people who approached him. Quinn waited, and when he saw him smile and wave at someone across the room, he decided this was the moment. He stood up and made eye contact, and by the time he was standing in front of Hemingway, he was saying, "I'm Daniel Quinn. I just quit the Miami Herald to write a novel, and you're responsible for me being out of a job. Does it bother you how many reporters you've led into poverty?" "Did you eat today?" Hemingway asked, frowning with his eyes. "I had breakfast." "You had breakfast and you're drinking rum at the best bar in Havana and you're crying poverty?" "I was exaggerating to make a point." "Keep it up and soon you'll have a novel," Hemingway said. His beard was white, and so was what was left of his hair, and he wore a white guayabera with long sleeves. He still had his stomach, but he was thinner than his photos and no longer the robust fisherman with the great chest and the big shoulders. "I may overcome my poverty," Quinn said. "The Time correspondent here may use me as a stringer. You think I can get an interview with Batista?"
"El presidente, hijo de la gran puta," said Hemingway.
"You know him?"
"No, thank you."
"Will you write about him?"
"Not in this lifetime. What are you writing?"
"Grim stories about political exiles in Miami buying guns to send to Cuba," Quinn said. "The grimness is redeemed by my simple declarative sentences. Remove the colon and semicolon keys from your typewriter," said Hemingway. "Shun adverbs strenuously. What do you think of the woman who's sitting at that far table?" Quinn looked at the young brunette at one of the square wooden tables. Sharp nose, large black eyes, full lips and a curvaceous smile that was radiant, her black hair falling just below her shoulders, and with a natural wildness in its curl. She was slender in a white blouse, tan skirt, and sandals.
"She's spectacularly beautiful," Quinn said. "I could fall in love with her right now. I might marry her."
"The young man was last seen charging into the unknown at full speed," Hemingway said. "A valiant but rash course of action. If you marry a woman like that, when do you write your novel?"
"After the honeymoon," Quinn said. "Who do you think she looks like?"
"Your daughter, Ava Gardner."
"You are clearly a born novelist," Hemingway said.
The beautiful brunette had come in with a man maybe 20 years her senior, and they were talking head to head. He was tall and thin, well-tailored in a tan cord suit, and his shoulders, his shoulders filled out. White shoes, a yellow tie, handsome figure who seemed overdressed for the very warm and humid night. He was giving close attention to the young beauty, and it was these two who had drawn the wave from Hemingway. "What is her relationship to the man?" Hemingway asked.
"Close," Quinn said, "but he wants it closer."
"You are closing in on chapter 6. "You know her? I saw you wave to her."
"I waved at the man, Max Osborne," Hemingway said. "He works in your abandoned profession, an editor at the Havana Post, very smart, and also an American spy who talks about his spying to everybody. Some people consider him a political buffoon, but that seems to be his cover. I know a great deal about spying. I was a spy for several years, and they called me a buffoon. They didn't know twiddle about the Nazis I hunted. Soon, Max will come over to talk to us."
"Will he bring the girl?" Quinn asked.
"Yes." "Then I won't have to contrive how to meet her." "A lucky day for Mr. Quinn. While we wait, we'll continue our analysis elsewhere. Tell me, who's the biggest jerk in this place?"
Quinn scanned the room and focused on three noisy American men standing at the bar, which was filling up. All tables already occupied. "The man in the sailor's straw hat and the orange shirt," Quinn said.
We'll drink a daiquiri and then test out your intuition," Hemingway said, and he ordered the drinks and told the bartender to ask the man in the sailor's straw to come over.
The three Americans stared at Hemingway, and then the man in the orange shirt came down the bar with a two-day growth of beard and a panatella between his teeth.
"How you doing, bub?" he said through the cigar. "You want to talk to me?"
"Just admiring your hat and wondering why you're in Cuba," Hemingway said.
"My wife thinks I'm at a sales convention in Miami, but we came down here on an airplane to gamble and check out the women."
"You're a sly devil. But this isn't the best place in Havana to gamble or to find women either."
"We already found them."
"Who are you?"
"Well, I'm Dr. Hemingstein, and this is my son, Daniel. And you?"
"Joe Cooney from Baltimore.
What kind of a sawbones are you, Dr. Hemingstein? I'm a doctor of writing, and I also actually write stuff. Hey, a writer, I'm a writer, too. I write new lyrics for old songs. Could you write a new lyric for Daniel and myself? Sure. Any particular song you like? You know, sliding down your cellar door? I learned it as a boy. Sure, I know it. You want me to do new lyrics for it? You think you can? Give me a few minutes. I'll sing them for you. Joe Cooney went away, and everybody smiled. So far, your intuition is getting high marks, Hemingway said to Quinn. The man and the beautiful brunette got up from their table. Here comes the bride, Hemingway said. Max made his hello and introduced his sister-in-law, Renata Suarez Otero. Hemingway introduced Quinn as his nephew. Quinn stared at Renata to engrave her beauty in his memory. He felt the impulse to take her face in his hand and kiss her before he spoke one word to her. He restrained himself and said only, "Hola." Is she a real sister-in-law, Max, or just cover for your spying on us here? Hemingway asked. I retired from spying last year, Max said. You can't trust anybody anymore. We are related, Renata said. Max married my sister, Esme. Esme Suarez. I know Esme, Hemingway said. She sang for the troops in Europe during the war. That's where she met Max. I've heard her sing. She has a large talent. Isn't she in New York? She was working on Broadway, Renata said, but she's back here now. Are you married yourself? I am wondering about it, Renata said. My nephew Daniel here is also wondering. In fact, he was wondering as he looked over at you a few minutes ago. In between his wonderments, he's writing a novel about Cuban gunrunners. He quit the Miami Herald to write his novel, and a splendid work it is, with 12 chapters so far. Did you meet the gunrunners, Daniel? Renata asked. I've met a few. Are they brave? They seem fearless, sometimes mindless. You think they believe in something, she asked. Yes, they believe in death. You know any gunrunners? I read about them in the newspaper, she said. Are you an actress? You're so beautiful. I'm learning to be a painter, she said. I would buy several tickets to see your paintings. Where would I do that? I work at Bellas Artes. I'll come and see you, Quinn said. I'd like your reaction to my stories on the gunrunners. All right, said Hemingway. That's settled. I have a friend who knew you in Spain, Renata said to Hemingway. Carlos Sosa Prieto. The last I saw Carlos, Hemingway said, government troops were chasing the fascists out of Teruel. A good man. Where is he now? In Havana. I would be glad to see him. Send him mis saludos. Mis saludos. Joe Cooney came back with a song in his heart. Are you ready for my lyrics, Dr. Hemingstein? Let me introduce you all to Joseph Cooney, the Baltimore Thrush, Hemingway said. He's going to sing an old song with new lyrics he just created for us. Fire away, maestro. Cooney sang enthusiastically and with bounce. Sliding down your cellar door. Sliding down your cellar door. What a thrill I had in store. Sliding down into the grass, 20 slivers in my ass. Thinking of those days gone by brings a teardrop to my eye. Wondering if I'll ever see cellar door that beckons me forevermore, slivers from your dear old door. Quinn watched Renata, who did not smile at the lyrics. She sees dementia in the man, he decided. Max was amused. Hemingway leaned over to Quinn and whispered, "You're right about Goonie Cooney. We're going to put him away." "How so?" Quinn said. "We'll have him sing it again, and at the finish, I'll throw him a right and cross with a left." "You're a harsh critic," Quinn said. "Maybe we should just temper our applause." Hemingway smiled and spoke to Cooney. "You write lyrics like a poet, like T.S. Eliot. But do it once more with emphasis. It needs emphasis." Cooney sang it again, and on "Slivers from Your Dear Old Door," he took off his hat and raised both his arms upward in an embrace of public lyricism. And he finished on an emphatic note that turned all heads in the bar. Hemingway hit him according to plan, a right and then a looping left, launching him backward until his head hit the wall near the door and he slid to the floor. As Hemingway was throwing the left, Max saw it rising, ducked sideways, and lost his balance. "Jesus, Ernest," Max said. "What was that?" "Sorry, Max," Hemingway said, helping him to his feet. "Didn't have you in mind. That's two knockdowns with one left." Renata's face registered confusion. "¿Qué es esto? ¿Estás bien?" she said to Max, and she took his arm. "Bien, bien," Max said, brushing dust off his coat and trousers. "He never laid a glove on me." Renata stared at Hemingway. "So brutal," she said. "Serás estúpido?" And she left at a brisk pace. Max followed her. Joe Cooney had not moved. His head was cocked against the wall. His two friends went to him and eased him down to lie flat, and a waiter put a towel under his head to blot his blood. "Get that man to the Casa de Socorros," Hemingway said to the bartender. "Está herido. Bring me a filet mignon." "Crudo?" asked the bartender. "Raw." The waiter went to the street to hail a passing car that would take Cooney to a first aid center. Cooney's friends were standing over him, staring at Hemingway. The bartender put a white plate with a raw steak in front of Hemingway, who wrapped it around his right hand. He lifted up the steak and showed his bleeding knuckles to Quinn. "See this? I've been out fishing. The skin is dry from the salt and the sun." "Otro doble," he said to the bartender. "I thought you were joking," Quinn said to Hemingway. "Jerks are no joke," he said. "Jerks should not be given house room." He said he was a writer. What kind of a jerk says that to a writer and he doesn't even know who he's talking to? Jerks and fools are a form of death when they turn up in your face. Singing that song in public is like writing a suicide note. I spent my life looking death in the eye and fighting it. He paused. "I didn't tell you what I was writing, did I?" "No, you didn't," Quinn said. "Not a suicide note. I'm reinventing my past in Paris, and I'm coming back with my trilogy." And he emptied his new double daiquiri with one uptip of the glass. "The land, the sea, and the air, and most of it's been written for years, but there's a future to think about, and if I put it out all at once, we could die of taxation from publication. They'll get it in time, and it'll knock them all in their ass. You'll be very proud of me, Mr. Quinn." "Didn't you do the sea and the old man?" "Only part of it. I did that for a woman. There's more to come, kid. Let's have two more dobles here. Dos más." When Quinn began publishing his own novels in later years, he looked at the notes he had made about Hemingway and about himself after this improbable night. And he understood there were important things he had left out, just as Hemingway had left things out when they talked. But as Hemingway had said, you can't leave out what you don't know. And in these years, he had three novels in progress and could not stop writing them or make them come together with meaning the way he could in the old days, because now everything had unendingly equal meaning and equal value. And he had left that out when he talked about it. Yet one must persevere. One must defy the forces that try to kill the spirit. One must not only persevere, one must prevail. And so Hemingway kept writing about what it was that was trying to ruin him, and the work became a love song to that. His 1-2 punches were part of it, just as Joe Cooney's cellar door was the Cooney love song to his own lack of talent. Witness my absent gift. See how well I apply it. Failure can also be a creative act, Quinn decided. One must look straight ahead as one makes the forced march backward into used history. The death of ambition, gentlemen, is a great impetus for grasping this, and soon you will thrill to how urgently you are moving, how truly exciting this quest for failure can be. What you do not know at this point is that your quest for failure may also fail. The waiter came in from the street and said he had found a car to take Cooney. One of the friends pointed to Hemingway, and he talked to the waiter, and the waiter nodded. A brawny young black man came in, and Hemingway introduced him to Quinn as his driver, Juan. Juan was alert to hostile possibility and stood by Hemingway monitoring the crowd. Cooney was conscious and talking with his friends, who helped him stand, then walked him to the street. The crowd in the restaurant stopped watching Hemingway and the tableau he had created and went back to drinking. A trio of black street singers with guitars came into the bar, but a waiter said they weren't welcome. One of them said they knew Hemingway was here and had written a song for him, Soy Como Soy, I Am What I Am, about a whore who can't be the woman Hemingway wants her to be. The waiter asked Hemingway if he wanted to hear the song, and he said he did. Quinn listened and drank his daiquiri. When the singers finished, Quinn asked him, ¿Conoce la canción Sliding Down My Cellar Door? No, señor, one singer said. Just as well, Quinn said. It's a very sad song. Hemingway gave the trio a $5 bill. Thank you.
Exchanging compliments up here. The way this works is you raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Who would like to start us off with a question? No. Okay. Gentlemen, in that case, I'll start us off with a question. Perhaps you could tell me what you think Hemingway would think about what you've written about him and whether or not you care. You would.
Me?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
It's on.
I never thought about that. What would Hemingway think? I didn't worry about it because he's dead. But he probably wouldn't like it because it's a true story. But more or less a true story. He tried to evade the truth, I think, when it reflected badly on him. But I think ultimately he would justify it and find a way to explain it. And if you read my novel, you'll find out what he thinks about it. I'm not going to tell you.
I think if I could respectfully disagree just a little, Bill, I have a feeling that he would have seen the truth of what you were writing about him, and that if not immediately, maybe when he sobered up the next day and was back at the Finca 9 miles from town, he would have nodded and said, damn it, that guy got it right. As I listened to Bill read that section, it made me think of so many things about Hemingway. You know, he used to say that all fiction is telling terrific lies about real people. It is rearranging what actually happened in such a way that it comes out truer than if it had actually happened. I recognized so much from what I know factually about Hemingway from that wonderful piece of fiction. This is a washed-up, tragic man who is trying desperately from the end of World War II onward to write the great land, sea, and air novel, as the novelist tells us this evening, and can't do it. One of the ways to read Hemingway's life is that everything came so quickly and so early. Fame came so quickly. And I think part of the heroic nature of Hemingway is that he kept going to his writing desk and struggling against the fact that he could no longer find those connective tissues to make it all work in which it had once come out so easily. So I think this boorish, very sad man who has to knock down somebody in a bar, I think Hemingway, I think he kidded everybody finally but himself. And that's why I think that final act, as grotesque as it is on that Sunday morning in Idaho, we can turn that inside out like a sock and see it in some ways as an act of courage rather than as an act of weakness and failure.
How much was he over your shoulder while you were writing the book?
Again?
How much was he over your shoulder while you were writing the book?
Since that last answer was too long, I'm going to answer this one very short and then hand the microphone. How much was he over my shoulder? Somebody asked me this in Washington, D.C. the other night. I mean, the Hemingway prose style is so seductive. He invented a new way of us hearing the American language. So the worst mistake I could have ever made was to try to write like Hemingway. I just had to keep true to whatever paltry, authentic voice that I feel I have. But he was sitting there at every turn, Andy, and I had to kill him off with every page and every paragraph.
You know, you raised an issue that about the way he talked about transforming real people into fictional people. And, you know, at the end of his life, here he is writing Garden of Eden, A Dangerous Summer. He's just finished and probably not even finished with it, but the Islands in the Stream, about the sea, and the Nats hunting the Nazis with the Pilar. And he's also... he's in the Garden of Eden. I have him say he's writing about his early days in Paris, and that was what he was writing about. He was also writing a movable feast, which was a tour de force. And what he had, you know, he had rediscovered after World War II when he came back to the Ritz Hotel in where he had stayed in his heyday in. Before the World War II, a trunk in the basement of the hotel, and it had, among other things, the early manuscript that eventually became, I don't know, I'm sure we can hear more about this from Paul, but what exactly was found in that trunk and how it became the Paris book about movable feast. But the difference was, in those days, what he was writing about real people and transforming them into fictional people, which is that book is short stories done just like I've done him here, and he did all the people he knew in Paris in The Sun Also Rises. And he was transforming them into real people in such a fantastically interesting way and with such great language. And at the end of his life, he wasn't able to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. He was doing it in a sense
in that Garden of Eden, but I think that's also an earlier manuscript. Maybe I'm wrong on this, but I think maybe he had started that in an earlier moment, too. Was it, Patty?
Very quickly, you raised so many interesting points. Yes, scholars are still trying to sort out the compositions of when and where in those Cuba years. That's still a period that we don't know that much about. He lived there the longest period, from 1940 till the end of his life, but he was fits and starts and stopping and putting this down and going to that. He had been working on the Garden of Eden through the 40s and into the 50s. Mm-hmm. I just would like to pick up on a point that Bill made about a movable feast. So many people in this room probably know that elegant memoir of his days in Paris. So many people think that from the mid-30s onward, it was downhill for Hemingway. He was washed up because fame had destroyed him, his ego. I don't see it that way. I see it like all our lives. It's a sine curve. And the fact that he was able to get in touch at the very end, when he was a ravaged man, physically, mentally, morally, with those Paris memories, because he was working on those. He really started them about 1957, at about the time that Bill is creating this wonderful fictional portrait of the man that we see in El Floridita. But he worked on those sketches in the last several years of his life. So this washed up wreck, paranoid of a human being, was still able to come up with something that sublime and that elegant and that beautiful. That being said, A Movable Feast has very cruel passages in it about people. But he recaptured, I think. I think he came all the way back with A Movable Feast. How many times have I been to Paris and have had my beat-up copy in various editions of A Movable Feast in my back pocket?
You know, one of the things that happened between the time when he first wrote those passages of Movable Feast and what he found in 45 when he came back to the Ritz Hotel was he became a different writer. I mean, this is 45 when he finds these things that he wrote probably in 1929, 30, 31, who knows? I mean, 25 maybe, 24, when he first went over to Paris. And he was this young man transforming his friends and strangers into whole human beings on the page. At the end of his life, here he is, he's writing this Dangerous Summer, which is this bullfight, the story of the mano a mano, Dominguez and the other bullfighter in Spain, and he followed them around, and he did it basically because Life magazine sent him there, and he was supposed to write something like a 30,000 word piece that would run in two issues of the magazine, and he couldn't stop writing.
It swelled to 120,000 words. It was like a goiter. He couldn't stop writing.
And A.E. Hotchkin went down finally after, you know, pleadings with him, you know, send us something. So Hotchkin went down and tried to make it work and tried to cut it because he had something like 150 or 170,000 words and he was still climbing. Maybe it was 200,000, I don't know. But he had begun to think of himself no longer as this kind of minimalist figure who could create such brilliant portraits in such a brief space in the Movable Feast. He now thought of himself as Marcel Proust, and he had to do the exhaustive treatment on this bullfight, these various bullfights, and he was finding every detail was valuable. And Hotchner would say, okay, we can cut this part here because there's a lot of, you know, just descriptions. No, he said, you can't cut that. No. And then Hotchner, well, how about this one? No, you can't cut that. He said, well, all right, let you go, Papa, and I'll stay in the other room and we'll work it out. And Hotchner comes in with, 240 pages, 50 pages of cuts. And Hemingway comes in with 73 words that he decided to cut. And he lost it.
whatever the hell had happened to him in his mind, he was, and a lot of things had happened to him, and so many injuries and such drinking, and you know, and his brain was addled, and he was also, and he everybody thought when they first heard the news that he had thought the FBI was pursuing him, that he had become paranoid, but the FBI was pursuing him. And they were following him, and we now know that from the FBI files.
The string, the FBI Hemingway file is as long as your arm. It's like the old bumper sticker. Even paranoids have enemies. In some clairvoyant way, he knew, even though he was also paranoid wildly about the FBI. You know, one of the burdens of Hemingway is that he becomes a figure on the world stage of literature so early. He writes The Sun Also Rises at the age of 25. It's published in 1926. He's 27 years old, and then he followed very quickly by A Farewell to Arms in 1929, so he's 30 years old. I think the expectations on him to become Marcel Proust, too, with every book, and that becomes such a self-defeating impulse after a while. He lost, but it cannot be discounted how much this man physically suffered. You know, he was always banging his head. He suffered two back-to-back surreal plane crashes in small planes in Africa, back-to-back on successive days in 1954, and stumbled from them to read his own obituaries. And of course, he was Ernest Hemingway. He had beaten, cheated death once more. I don't think so. I think he was wrecked terribly from the inside and the outside, but we didn't. The myth was that he's this superhuman. He wasn't. But I wish to think that even this pathetic man in the famous corner of the Floridita, making an ass of himself, really beside a bronze bust of himself, was still the next morning when he sobered up willing to go to that desk and try to put something down on paper. And that's a pretty heroic idea.
Why don't we throw it open to the audience for a couple of questions. Gentleman in the blue here, about four rows back, please wait for the mic.
It's obvious that you love Hemingway, but was he a great writer? There was a lot of controversy about whether he was considered to be a great writer. I do feel that way about him. And also, a secondary question that ties in, is there a today Hemingway, or recent last 10 or 15 years Hemingway, in your opinion, writer like Hemingway anywhere around?
Could you repeat that question?
I'm sort of looking at it now, but he was asking if there's, the second part of the question is there a writer like Hemingway today, and is he considered as, do you think he's as great as some people say he is?
Do I think Hemingway is as great as people say he is?
Yeah, or not, because there's criticism.
I'll defer to the...
In 1983, awaiting my first child, read the first sentence of a book called Ironweed, and that first sentence is, riding up the winding road of St. Agnes Cemetery in the back of a rattling old truck, Francis Phelan became aware that the dead, even more than the living, settled down in neighborhoods. I was drawn in and hooked by that first sentence. So, I would say that up here on this stage is somebody that I feel has written often with the power of a Hemingway. And I don't know whether... was Hemingway a great writer? He's not for everybody, is he? And it took me a long time to get on to the beauty of his style. I didn't quite get it. I said, these Dick and Jane go up the hill to fetch a pail of water sentences. What's the big deal about that? This strange declarative music without the subordinate clause. I yoked by the word and with no commas. Look, he's the easiest guy in the world to parody. Anybody can parody a Hemingway sentence, but can anybody write a Hemingway sentence? I think he reinvented the language. I think he's up at the top.
I would agree with that. I think that, his... So much acknowledgement of what his achievement was as a force for transforming American literature into something that it had not been before. And he's the first to agree that he learned from Sherwood Anderson and Stephen Crane on this minimalist kind of short story writing in the minimalist language and in a direct language onto the action and get rid of the Baroque is over is what he wrote in the Green Hills of Africa, I think he said, when he was talking about Thomas Wolfe and this expansive poetic prose that Wolfe had written in Look Homeward, Angel, and Time in the River, and all the rest of his books. And Wolfe was at that time at a pinnacle, just like Hemingway. But he didn't stay on the pinnacle. And nobody did. Faulkner did. Faulkner did something else. There were those two great writers, Faulkner and Hemingway. And Faulkner did something totally else outside of what Hemingway did. But that's another. I mean, I'd have to write another novel about it, have Faulkner in a bar, you know. But Hemingway was his prose was so interesting and. I mean, you can get thousands and thousands of people to disagree with what I'm saying. People hate Hemingway. Some people hate Hemingway and think he's childish and he writes for 10-year-olds. But that's not true. That's not true. He wrote most elegant prose and his language and his dialogue and the way he told stories, the succinctness and what he left out of the stories. That line I quoted, you can't leave out what you don't know. And he always talked about that iceberg principle. I mean, that was a cliche about him. But he had gotten at the point of what he was really doing, which was the point of telling very, very large emotional stories with a minimum amount of exposition and even the dialogue was minimal. And he was a minimalist and way before they decided that was a movement in the 60s. But he was a terrific, terrific, interesting writer. I mean, those books are, even the bad books, I mean, the things that he failed in, like To Have and Have Not, which is a mess, but it's a terrifically interesting book. And,
Across the River and Into the Trees.
Across the River and Into the Trees. It's got great stuff in it somewhere, yeah, you know. Yeah. But there's fatuous stuff in it also. I mean, not everybody wins every time out. Some you win, some you lose, some get rained out. But Hemingway won more than a lot of guys.
E.L. Doctorow once said in a review of somewhere about Hemingway, he said he was a genius who advertised his own limitations. I think there's some truth in
who,
that.
Who advertising what?
Who advertised his own limitations. Bill referenced the iceberg theory. The essence of that, sir, is that Hemingway said the dignity of an iceberg is the fact that 7/8 of it are underwater. And you might say that Hemingway was a minimalist who became a maximalist because he couldn't figure out what to leave out. And that's part of the tragedy that he became.
We've got time for one more question right on the aisle here.
Bill, can I call you Bill?
If you call him Paul.
Okay. I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about the act of extracting the fictional Hemingway from the so-called factual Hemingway. And as a corollary to that, if you could talk about the transition of Quinn from Miami Herald reporter to novelist.
Well, you know, Hemingway is no different from anybody else that I've ever written about. When you transform... You decide to write about somebody or something that has taken hold of you and made itself fodder for your imagination, and you begin to shape. It's like sculpting out of clay, and you feel that something is taking shape, and it's if you're writing about your father, which I also do in this novel, I'm writing about my father, or when I was writing about Legs Diamond the Gangster in my second novel, Legs, it was no different from what I'm writing about Hemingway. Hemingway was a real character. I had to deal with Legs Diamond. I didn't want to betray him either. I don't think I betrayed Hemingway. I don't think I betrayed Legs Diamond. As a matter of fact, my wife had a dream. After I finished the book, Jack Diamond knocked on our door, and she answered the door, and then she didn't see him and see anybody. And then she looked, and Jack Diamond had gone down the steps, and he was on his back in the grass, kicking his feet in the air. And she came down and said, "What's going on?" And she said, "He said to her, he said, I just wanted to tell Bill he got it just right." Well, you know, I spent 6 years writing Legs Diamond, and much of it was finding out. Two of those years spent probably under the microfilm machine. You couldn't hit the internet and find anything you wanted in 30 seconds in those days. And it was painful, but I loved it. And I immersed myself in the age and everything else. But it was, you're dealing, what you're looking for is knowledge around the inspiration, whatever the hell it is, that you are trying to shape into some clay. And that's nebulous and abstract. And I can't really define it very clearly on what you, how you create a character. My father, it was easy. But with Leg Diamond, it got to be easy. You know what he'll do. You watch his behavior, her behavior, whoever she is, and you imagine what she would say, and then what you know about that character from research, from elimination of possibilities of one kind of behavior. And then you are left with the rest, and that's what you use. And so Hemingway is just another character in the world for me. And same with Fidel Castro. Although I was a little more meticulous with Fidel because I wanted to have him other. There's an interview with Fidel in the novel, and I wanted to have him be reflect what he was really thinking. But he says things that he never said, and I don't know whether he's read the novel yet. But if he doesn't like it, I may not go to Cuba. But it's a choice that you make, and you're trying to create a character who's of the moment as best you can place him in his own history, her own history, and also to suit your story. I mean, Hemingway behaves as he does in my story in ways that there's things that he does in this novel that he never did. But he might have done them, and I think that he would approve, ultimately, of what he does in the novel. He may not like this particular scene, but he might. But I think he'd like the other one. Anyway, it's so hard to figure out how you're doing. But I really, basically what I'm saying is that the difference between treating an ordinary invention for your characters as a character, creating a character, is no different for an anonymous figure like my novel Roscoe. There was no such person as Roscoe, but the Roscoe was flesh and blood, I think, on the page. But I try to tell that story from so many real people's point of view, and none of them worked. And I don't know why. I have forgotten why, but I tried and failed, tried and failed. And then I had to invent a person who never existed in the history of Albany politics. And
So he could be close to the top and yet not the top, and close to the bottom workings, and et cetera. I mean, I'm just yammering. I got to stop.
I think we will stop there. Two fine writers. Please join me in thanking William Kennedy and Paul Hendrickson.
That was great.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.